All right. So our first speaker is Susan Smith from, as you can read, Indiana School of Public Health, Bloomington.
In this session, I'm sort of the broad overview person. I teach graduate emergency management threat assessment and facility emergency planning courses at Indiana University, as well as some courses related to health education and health promotion. And what I'm going to go over today really quickly are just some of the effective strategies that have been found in the few case studies and the research that's been done for local responders that have been found to be effective over time. And please ask questions. I was hauling a box to our booth, so I didn't bring printout out copies of the handout that I have, although I turned it in on the web. And if anybody would like a printed out handout, I've got two sessions on Wednesday, and I'm lugging those in for that. So if you really want a printed out version of it, you're welcome to it. And I'm trying to think, when I loaded it up, I think you could load up in Word. If you couldn't, I had to convert it to a PDF, but the handout is actually an assessment tool, and if they let it go in Word, you can actually modify it for your own use. Overall, I'm going to use collaboration and coordination pretty much interchangeably and together because they're kind of components of the same thing. And response agencies at the local level can range from emergency responders. They can be fire, rescue, hospitals, public health facilities, mental health facilities, anybody that's working on the local community level. We do know from some of the research that's been done in 2005 that narrowly designed collaborative projects that are kind of task-oriented lead to much more effective cooperation rather than sort of broad general efforts that really don't have a goal or any sort of direct objective. But these are the things I really want to talk about. These are the five characteristics that have been found through a whole bunch of different research that we've dug together. I don't know that they've been stuck in the list like this before, that if you do these things, your response efforts are going to be more effective, and because of that, your responders are going to be in a safer position to do a good job, because if you know what the other guy's doing and you're familiar with the other people, then you're going to be safer to do your job and know what you're doing. But the very first component is strong familiarity and trust among the groups and group members that are working together. And one of the things that's been found is that, and I don't know that it's not obvious, but in small communities, there's a higher level of familiarity and in some ways more effective response because people know each other better. The second is effective communication and collaboration and motivation, kind of all going together. The type of work associations and boundaries. A history of collaborative training and drills and exercises. It's not the first time you've done something. And a recognition by group leaders that stress will increase during a crisis and that stress levels can change depending on the decisions are made and to have some effective mechanisms in place to deal with stress. So the first one I want to talk about a little bit is familiarity and trust. And as I mentioned earlier, we have found that smaller communities have been found to exhibit a higher level of cooperation among similar response groups than if you lived in a larger community. And the members may know each other on a day-to-day basis, not just when you go to have a response. And one of the things we found that was most interesting was a fire department on the edge of in Europe, and there was a fire department on either side of a country line. And for 20 years, they've worked collaboratively by doing things like getting fire hose connections that will fit the other country's fire hydrants and putting interpreters on the trucks, but also having social events throughout the year so that they've been able to cooperate across country lines. And that's been real successful. It's hard to get documented cases where that's been going on, but it really does work. Communication, as I mentioned earlier, is really important, and there's technological ability to communicate, the sociological aspects, and the organizational aspects. And actually, you have to have communication in all three of those areas if your response is going to be effective. And sometimes people will, in local communities, I know in the states I've worked in Tennessee, at the University of Tennessee, Western North Carolina, and Indiana, sometimes different response agencies will end up with different radio frequencies, different types of radios. They can't communicate. During Katrina and Rita, for example, the Guard and the local fire department, none of those radios were the same type, and they couldn't communicate back and forth. So just the technology of being able to communicate is important. But sociologically, in terms of understanding the values and the customs of the different people, just like across that country line, and organizationally, communicating who is doing what, which is really important. Boundaries. There are boundaries between organizations and groups, and they can either serve as a barrier or they can serve as a way to determine who should do what and do a good job. And one way to facilitate having boundaries not be a problem and having the relationships be resilient over time is to ensure that there are informal networks between individuals. The amount of time the groups spend together, like we talked about having some social functions, and what are the geographic distances between collaborating groups. It reminds me, at the University of Tennessee, some president got the bright idea to make the University of Tennessee Medical School and the University of Tennessee Knoxville one campus. The only problem is the medical school is in Memphis, and we are in Knoxville, which is like a million miles and a whole time zone apart. And you're not going to get much collaboration when you have that kind of distance involved. So being aware of the distance is important. Exercise and drills. Why do people need them? For one reason, they need them to clarify their role and what they're going to do as part of a team or an agency. And it also allows them to be redefined or expanded during an evaluation session. And I'm the one that encourages people to have real evaluators there, because if you just have all the local collaborators, all of a sudden they get ooey-gooey nice during the evaluation because they think in the hot wash, if they tell you you did something wrong, maybe you won't come back next time. So in order to have much of an evaluation, you really have to have separate people do the evaluation. And once I was on a team where I was a pod communicating with pods on an anthrax operation in Tennessee, and one of the directors, we said, send out a fax to tell people they can take doxycycline, it's going to work, because we're out of Cipro, and we were going to see how fast they could do that and get it faxed out. Instead, we get a call back from one of the head guys that says, well, you know doxycycline won't work on anthrax. At which time I said, well, my doctors say they do, and I hand it to the state epidemiologist, who chews on this guy for not reading the analysis of the anthrax, which showed the doxycycline would work. But we would have never known that that person thought it wouldn't work, or that some of the ways when you called in, you got shunted to another extension that was a dead end. The only way you find those things out is by going through real training and drills. I will say I hope that person never knew my name at the end of that evaluation. But to reduce territoriality, it's really important to have good cooperation among agencies so that everybody knows what their role is and they feel like they have one and not that they're just stepping on each other's. And stress, I don't know how many years ago this might not have been on the list, but one of the things that has been found is if an agency has a way to deal with stress, and unfortunately because of budget cuts, police departments are whacking their connections with mental health organizations and somebody that their police can go to for stress reduction, and I'm sure other people are too, but that's really important. And they found that if the leaders of a group understand that stress is real and they understand what stress can do, then they're much better able to deal with stress as it occurs and to manage people. I know after 9/11, at least two-thirds of my class were manning EOCs, and I don't think any of them had slept in 2 weeks. And I think by now they're at least trying to rotate people so people get some sleep and eat something other than donuts. But there are a lot of issues that people need help with. Death of a coworker, occupational stress, can be family and marital problems. You're out dealing with an emergency. What's happening with your family? In North Carolina, when after one of the hurricanes, there were just severe storms. The emergency responders are out saving people, and the individual's house washes away, and all his family's killed in a flash flood. So knowing where your children are and your family is important. One of the things that is strongly advocated, if you want to have collaboration, is to at least have twice a year joint practice operations, and to make sure that everybody knows how to use the equipment that's available in case there are differences in equipment or technologies between the groups that are collaborating together. And funding does make a difference. For 13 years, I was at the University of Tennessee, and I can tell you Anderson County has the best emergency response capacity in all of Tennessee and half the South, and that's because they have funding from Oak Ridge, which is sitting in the middle of their county. And all that extra funding allowed Knox County and other counties around to have much better capacity and to fund a lot more exercises and training. So the idea that it doesn't take money is a little weird. Also, it's important to train civilians, and I know from some research that children, like third and fourth graders, if you train them to evacuate from a room, forget videos and TVs and crap like CDs, but if you put a hair dryer under the door and you have them feel the heat and you help them figure out an alternative way to get out of a room, they retain that for about 4 to 6 months. And I don't think adults are any better than children at that. So to me, it requires repetitive and ongoing interaction. So just remember, you need to conduct pre-planning and hands-on training and communicate within your organization because it helps the safety of your emergency responders, maintain education and awareness, and make sure you use something called the 10-point checklist. And these are the sections of the checklist, and it's about 12 pages. It was designed for residential schools, nonprofit organizations, and colleges, but it's been used by power plants and all kinds of public organizations to go through every 3 months and inventory everything you have. You have it, does it work? If it doesn't work, you check it off. You hand that in to the purchasing agent in a fast track and get stuff fixed. You don't let it stay around and be delayed. And that's on the, where in the world they put the handouts that they were determined we were going to send up in advance. And each section, this was actually developed by 9/11 and expanded a little bit after that and put up on the web by the National Safety Council right after 9/11. But really, a regular apartment complex, it works fine, not a Twin Towers, in my opinion. But these there's everything from audible to visual alarms, because when it was developed, we figured we had about 250 years of occupational health and safety people developing it, my graduate students, and it was with the Tennessee School for the Deaf that had 40 facilities and 100 acres of land. So by the time we got through all those things, we'd probably hit every weird situation you can think of. So that's really the end of my presentation, since at APHA it's more like an advertisement. I'm spoiled. Other places you get an hour and you really kill people then. But you've got to recognize and take actions to establish trust and familiarity, communication, and work associations within your organization as a responding organization and also with others that are responding. Collaborative training and drills and exercises. And believe me, doctors are the worst to get to go along, so you don't really have to work on them. And at the response agency level, you have to recognize stress and take actions to address stress. And then continuous assessment of your facility. The people that are working there are the ones that have got to help respond to other people. If something happens in their own organizational facility, is involved in an emergency or disaster, you want to be prepared. Well, you know, in the Twin Towers, that's where they had the EOC, and so many of their people were killed. But to be able to go through and make sure you're prepared as much as you can so that you don't, your responders are not at risk at home. That's it.